Welcome back to the Four Aids, the first chapter in the Yoga of Divine Works. And the only section of the synthesis of yoga that Sri Aurobindo thoroughly rethought and revised. There are substantial changes in this chapter. The first two of the aids that we've already talked about, the Shastra, the teaching, and Utsaha, the enthusiasm, the zeal that we bring to the practice, set up the stage for us now to look at the nature of the teacher. As the supreme Shastra of the integral yoga is the eternal Veda secret in the heart of every man, so its supreme guide and teacher is the inner guide, the world teacher, Jagat Guru, secret within us. It is he who destroys our darkness by the resplendent light of his knowledge. That light becomes within us the increasing glory of his own self-revelation. He discloses progressively in us his own nature of freedom, bliss, love, power, immortal being. He sets above us his divine example as our ideal and transforms the lower existence into a reflection of that which it contemplates. By the inpouring of his own influence and presence into us, he enables the individual being to attain to identity with the universal and transcendent. So the idea of the guru is really immemorial. We don't know. It's beyond our memory, really, when the idea took root in India. We find it most powerfully presented in the tantric lineage. Guru, as we've said before, is a word that means heavy, having weight, having substance, therefore, and strength because of having substance. So the guru is one who can deliver a helping hand, who can really assist. But in the tantra, it's more specialized and more suggestive than that. Normally you find in the tantras, which are books of ritual, a dialogue between the god and the goddess, between Shiva and Parvati or Uma, or in the Vaishnava tradition, between Bhagavan and Lakshmi or Sri. And in the dialogue, one teaches the other a secret. Sometimes there are tantras in which the goddess teaches the god, shares her knowledge with the divine lord. But always, the secret teaching is away from other ears, delivered privately, and requires an initiation. There has to be a purity in the recipient that can withstand the flow of that knowledge, the force of that knowledge. Its immaculate nature must find a ready house into which it is poured. So the tantras are ritualistic, yes, but They lean on four bases, you might say, four feet. The Vidya Pada, where it is an instruction of knowledge, Jnana Pada, to inculcate, to awaken in the aspirant the actual experience that leads to identity. The Kriya Pada is meant to take the ritualistic action which will install the purity in the nature so that one can get the knowledge. The Yoga Pada obviously is going to develop your capacity to practice yoga. That means to yoke all of your being to the goal. Not part of your being, but all of your being. So it will have physical, vital, emotional, and intellectual demands. And finally, Charya Pada. How it is that you conduct yourself, having received this new knowledge, having attuned your being, having brought an energy into your whole life that was not there before, how do you conduct yourself in the world? There's a responsibility that if the teacher transmits to you through these various methods, this forceful light, that you will use it well, that we will use it for the greater good of the world, not simply for your own self. So the sadhana that you practice, the path that takes you straight to the goal, comes on the basis of this initiation. Now, we're always thinking about what are the things that the guru should have, what kind of qualities of perfection should the guru have so that we don't become disappointed and turn away, because there's a human element here or there. But more important for us is what are the qualities that the aspirant should have? Truth, nobility, candor, capacity for self-assessment, vigorous in work, just a few. We take up then as seekers, under the masterful guidance of the guru, a ritual that brings purity so that divinity can be placed in the being where clearly before there was obscurity. Instead, now there's candor, transparency, and the divine can take possession of that place. And to that end, towards placing the divinity even in the physical body, one takes up the meaningful gestures, the mudra. One takes up the empowered word, the mantra. One uses the visualization that's powerfully present in the yantra, all to drive the being towards this unification. And when one achieves perfection, when one is awake to the nature of the spirit within and has enlivened all the sheaths of the being representing the goddess with that conscious energy, then you have a merger which redounds to the benefit of the whole cosmos. There's a cosmological significance in the individual attaining union with the divine. It rolls out into the world. So one aims at knowledge, yes, but one aims also at siddhi, the perfection of the being, and then at bhoga, the delight of all existence when it's unmasked as the sheer divine. Then really, there is no ego, there is no desire left, because you are in the midst constantly of universal experience. So, to set this up, of course, you have to be able to receive the initiation from the guru. And there are seven kinds, of course, that the Kulārṇava Tantra talks about. There's the one that you get through ritual where they sit and they go with you and lead you step by step, letter by letter. There's the type of initiation, though, that you can get when you read something that has been written by a powerful sage, and the force of that word enters into you, and you respond. Another is by emanation, where you actually catch the vibration of the guru and respond to that and are brought into that atmosphere. Another by touch. It touches the palm of your head. You touch the feet in prostration and pranam, and through and into you runs a great power. Shaktipat. Also, through speech, you hear the authentic voice, and you know through its power that it is true. Sight. The guru simply looks at you, and in that seeing, you're startled into wakefulness. You're jarred out of your normal world. You're awakened to something new. And last, of course, the guru simply thinks of you. And in that thought, you are caught. He who chooses the infinite has been chosen by the infinite. Now, Sri Aurobindo himself had very little need of an external teacher. Lele mentioned to him, as they sat on the roof in the town of Baroda, that he should stop thoughts from entering in, as if they were sailing in like on a vessel, and he would turn them away, and in moments, really, he attained silence. But it became a perfect silence in 3 days. He never really needed instruction from Lele thereafter. So that simple word, as when Krishna heard the word from his teacher in thousands of years back, immediately flashed awake. So too, Sri Aurobindo. Later, when Lele checked up with him and said, "Are you meditating regularly?" Sri Aurobindo said, "No," which was alarming to Lele. But Sri Aurobindo didn't go on to say that really the meditation was constant. Meditation would be for him and for advanced practitioners only an intensification of that which is normally concentrated on that one reality which is everywhere present. But those were the days when Sri Aurobindo was engulfed in that Brahmic Nirvana. He was liberated from the fictitious ego, from the phantasmagorial universe. But when he was placed in the Alipur jail, then he developed a real and lasting kinship to the divine as teacher, to the Jagat Guru, the world teacher. Jagad means world, from that which moves. And if it moves, then all the universe moves. So Jagat means the moving universe. And Guru, what is heavy, as we said. And now there are some teachings which say that Guru means light, which dispels darkness. And that's a very interesting philosophy, but clearly the word means what is substantial. So Sri Aurobindo's relationship with whom he called Krishna, developing in the Alipur jail, never really ceased. And he was led from within, from his own experience. He needed no outer word, did not rely on a teaching, went back to the Rig Veda, back to the Upanishads, back to the Gita, and found there in all of these elements of his own experience, So they confirmed what was developing within him. And that's important to have confirmation, especially when you're an adventurer or a pioneer like Sri Aurobindo. You have to validate what your experience is. You can check it out in life and see if the power of your illumination extends into objects, into events, etc. And he did that. But to be able to go back and see that his experience was captured in pregnant phrases by earlier teachers was very meaningful to him. So when he writes here about the inner guide, the world teacher, he's writing from experience. When he says he discloses progressively in us his own nature, that was Sri Aurobindo's experience. Not only as an example, but as a descending power that transforms the lower existence into a reflection of that. You remember that we've pointed out that the Tantra insists on this, that the text that one reads invokes the power of the goddess who descends into that area of the being which is being focused upon and fixes her conscious nature there, displacing the obscure human nature. So this is all a progressive displacement of what is limited by what is infinite. We are inviting and offering various aspects of our being as tables placed with food, waiting for the gods to come, descend, and consume that offering. And in the consuming, we become them. They become us. There is a fusion of being into being. By the inpouring of his own influence and presence into us, he enables the individual being to attain to identity with the universal and transcendent. So the three terms of being, the individual representing the cosmic, representing the transcendent, becomes the perfect focus for all three here. So the world can be redeemed from within through the force of a person's realization. By success in the yoga, you can change the world. What is his method and his system? He has no method and every method. His system is a natural organization of the highest processes and movements of which the nature is capable. Applying themselves even to the pettiest details and to the actions, the most insignificant in their appearance, with as much care and thoroughness as to the greatest, they in the end lift all into the light and transform all. For in his yoga, there is nothing too small to be used and nothing too great to be attempted. As the servant and disciple of the master has no business with pride or egoism, because all is done for him from above, so also he has no right to despond because of his personal deficiencies or the stumblings of his nature. For the force that works in him is impersonal or superpersonal and infinite. Aspiration, rejection, and surrender, as he would write a dozen years later. As long as the aspiration is pure, then that will burn up the fire of the ego. And ego has two sides, doesn't it? The one is that I'm so great, and the other is I'm so poor. Neither is particularly helpful on the path of the yoga. So let that come into us. Let that sunshine fill our being, and we will necessarily be on the sunlit path. Superpersonal. The force that works in him is impersonal. Think of this. In the Gita, that is the akshara Purusha. That personhood, if you can say it so, which is identical with the Atman, which is imperishable, lifted above the world, transcendent, or super-personal. That's the Purushottama, the supreme being, transcendent to the transcendence, which uses the transcendence of Brahman, of the Akshara Purusha, as a means, as a base, as a field, as a source through which it manifests the world and inevitably draws the world back to it, and the conscious beings who aspire through that liberating experience of the Akshara Purusha back to emergence in the superpersonal, in the Purushottama, where you recover all possibilities and you have the integral experience of the transcendence, what you are in it, what you are as part of the all. And then when you return to action in the world, you have a liberating light and a great force in you. The full recognition of this inner guide, master of the yoga, Lord, light, enjoyer, and goal of all sacrifice and effort, is of the utmost importance in the path of integral perfection. It is immaterial whether he is first seen as an impersonal wisdom, love, and power behind all things, as an absolute manifesting in the relative and attracting it, as one's highest self and the highest self of all, as a divine person within us and in the world, in one of his or her numerous forms and names, or as the ideal which the mind conceives. In the end, we perceive that he is all and more than all these things together. The mind's door of entry to the conception of him must necessarily vary according to the past evolution and the present nature. So as our experience grows, we see the fuller and fuller nature of that great being who leads us. He comes in one guise, drops it when it is no longer necessary, and reveals a fuller inlook into that being. This inner guide is often veiled at first by the very intensity of our personal effort and by the ego's preoccupation with itself and its aims. So we begin imperfectly. We begin, we still have an ego, and we start practicing yoga. And we're working so hard, we can't be aware or sensitive to the strings that are being plucked by that being who orchestrates the world and all the affairs. So we don't know that. And we don't know that our insistence on the Shastra, the teaching that we're convinced is the right one, is blinding us to the larger teaching which he can provide. As we gain in clarity and the turmoil of egoistic effort gives place to a calmer self-knowledge, we recognize the source of the growing light within us. So we become aware of the building power of the soul and find that at the core of our soul is that. We are not different. And if we are waking up again, it's because the divine is waking us up. We recognize it retrospectively. As we realize how all our obscure and conflicting movements have been determined towards an end that we only now begin to perceive, how even before our entrance into the path of the yoga, the evolution of our life has been designedly led towards its turning point. For now we begin to understand the sense of our struggles and efforts, successes and failures. I think there's a letter that Sri Aurobindo writes to a disciple living in the ashram at some point in the 1930s, many years after this, in which he suggests, just look behind you. You think you're not making progress. Look where you were when you started. Take stock and note the progress. Note the preparation that has been laid. Note how things are building to fruition. Don't despair. The human mind, the ego, can't accurately forecast what the next step is. And the voices that would declaim our advance, that would stall or retard or deflect, are very eager to stop you from getting to that light. And often it happens that we cease and desist just on the moment which is being born, where the illumination is rising through the darkness. We stop a step too soon. So keep going. At last, we are able to seize the meaning of our ordeals and sufferings and can appreciate the help that was given us by all that hurt and resisted, and the utility of our very falls and stumblings. We recognize this divine leading afterwards, not retrospectively, but immediately in the molding of our thoughts by a transcendent seer, of our will and actions by an all-embracing power, of our emotional life by an all-attracting and all-assimilating bliss and love. We recognize it, too, in a more personal relation that from the first touched or at the last seizes us. We feel the eternal presence of a supreme master, friend, lover, teacher. We recognize it in the essence of our being as that develops into likeness and oneness with a greater and wider existence. For we perceive that this miraculous development is not the result of our own efforts. An eternal perfection is molding us into its own image. One who is the Lord or Ishvara of the yogic philosophies, the guide in the conscious being, Chaitya Guru or Antaryamin, the absolute of the thinker, the unknowable of the agnostic, the universal force of the materialist, the supreme soul and the supreme Shakti, the one who is differently named and imaged by the religions, is the master of our yoga. To see, know, become, and fulfill this one in our inner selves and in all our outer nature was always the secret goal and becomes now the conscious purpose of our embodied existence. To be conscious of him in all the parts of our being and equally in all that the dividing mind sees as outside our being is the consummation of the individual consciousness. To be possessed by him and possess him in ourselves and in all things is the term of all empire and mastery. To enjoy him in all experience of passivity and activity, of peace and of power, of unity and of difference, is the happiness which the jiva, the individual soul manifested in the world, is obscurely seeking. This is the entire definition of the aim of integral yoga. It is the rendering in personal experience of the truth which universal nature has hidden in herself and which she travails to discover. It is the conversion of the human soul into the divine soul and of natural life into divine living. And the only thing to add to that is that Sri Aurobindo does not confine this to an individual perfection, to one point of illumination in the world, but that it should have social extension. He meant for his ashram to be alight with this force, with this transformed nature. He meant then to extend that illumination broadly through India and through the world. And so he began it. Shall we continue it? So that's a place we will put our bookmark in, and we'll take up the continuing pages on the nature of the teacher next time. This is from Savitri. This is Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. This is on page 46. On a height he stood that looked towards greater heights. Our early approaches to the infinite, our sunrise splendors on a marvelous verge, while lingers yet unseen the glorious sun. What now we see is a shadow of what must come. The earth's uplook to a remote unknown is a preface only of the epic climb of human soul from its flat earthly state to the discovery of a greater self and the far gleam of an eternal light. This world is a beginning and a base where life and mind erect their structured dreams. An unborn power must build reality. A death-bound littleness is not all we are. Immortal, our forgotten vastnesses await discovery in our summit selves. Unmeasured breadths and depths of being are ours. Akin to the ineffable secrecy, mystic, eternal in unrealized time, neighbors of heaven are nature's altitudes. To these high-peaked dominions sealed to our search, too far from surface nature's postal routes, too lofty for our mortal lives to breathe, deep in us a forgotten kinship points, and a faint voice of ecstasy and prayer calls to those lucent lost immensities. Even when we fail to look into our souls or lie embedded in earthly consciousness, still have we parts that grow towards the light, yet are there luminous tracts and heavens serene and Eldorados of splendor and ecstasy and temples to the Godhead none can see. A shapeless memory lingers in us still, and sometimes, when our sight is turned within, earth's ignorant veil is lifted from our eyes. There is a short, miraculous escape. This narrow fringe of clamped experience we leave behind, meted to us as life, our little walks, our insufficient reach. Our souls can visit in great lonely hours still regions of imperishable light, all-seeing eagle peaks of silent power and moon-flame oceans of swift, fathomless bliss, and calm immensities of spirit space. In the unfolding process of the self, sometimes the inexpressible mystery elects a human vessel of descent. A breath comes down from a supernal air, a presence is born, a guiding light awakes. A stillness falls upon the instruments, fixed, motionless, like a marble monument, stone calm. The body is a pedestal supporting a figure of eternal peace. Or a revealing force sweeps blazing in out of some vast superior continent. Knowledge breaks through, trailing its radiant seas, and nature trembles with the power, the flame. A greater personality sometimes possesses us, which yet we know is ours. Or we adore the master of our souls. Namaste. Jai Ma.